You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are once again joined by our expert in studio, Professor Alan Blackman. Hello, Alan.
Hey, Castor. I'm going to have a big shout out to two regular listeners.
Ooh, we
have regular listeners, Sue and Lindsay in Waipu.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Who sent me a very nice email. And guys, there will be no double ups this week, okay?
No double ups of...
Oh, just a little private joke there
between us. All right.
It's good to know that people are listening, so thank you for that.
That's good to hear. Dear Science, one of my favourite parts of the Tuesday Wire, probably my favourite part of the Tuesday Wire, now that I think about it, there's always a joy to be had in listening to these wacky and wonderful stories in the world of science. Also, Yosef, your first time on Dear Science, what do you think about science broadly?
It terrifies me.
Okay, that's good, because there's going to be a test. So.
Yeah, we've got lots of interesting stuff. let's start off with perhaps the least terrifying of these stories.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. now that I'm thinking about it, or the most, depending on your perspective.
Indeed.
What's going on with these plants, Alan?
Right, so obviously we need to stop putting carbon into the atmosphere, don't we? Mm. And what people want is to have some sort of idea of just how much carbon that plants sequester, because we're sort of relying on the plants to take a fair old whack of CO2 out of the atmosphere and convert that to good old carbohydrates and things
That's plant classic, materials, famous, basically. Famous strategy, right? Plant more trees.
There we go. So then the question is, as I say, how much carbon are they actually sequestering? So... And when they sequester the carbon, where are they sequestering it? Because if you think about it, right, let's talk about a tree, for example. So we've got a tree. It's got a big old trunk. All the carbon in that trunk is going to be there for the life of the tree, basically, isn't it?
Right.
What about the leaves? Okay, so if you've got a deciduous tree, then they shed their leaves every year.
Right.
And so therefore the carbon that is in those leaves is going to go back into the atmosphere as it decomposes.
Okay? I'm guessing the same if someone chops off a branch or falls off.
All that sort of stuff. So so it does matter whereabouts in the tree the carbon is sequestered, okay? Now, there's a link here between this study and the atomic bomb, which you might think tenuous, but in fact it's not.
Right.
So it might be interesting to people that the first atomic bomb was exploded exactly 1 week and 79 years ago today.
Ooh, that is quite close.
At the Trinity test site. Okay, those of you who have probably seen Oppenheimer, which I still need to watch.
Oh, it's very good.
Yeah, okay, everyone says. So what this and all of the other atomic bomb tests that occurred in the atmosphere did was to put a radioactive isotope of carbon into the atmosphere. So carbon-14, which you may have heard of in terms of a thing called carbon dating.
Yeah.
And this was adding essentially anthropomorphic carbon to the atmosphere, okay? So this is sort of human generated carbon coming from these nuclear bomb tests.
Yep.
And so there was a bunch of workers in the UK and the USA and Germany, and they're sort of thinking, well, is there any way that we can sort of use these data to figure out just how much of that anthropomorphic carbon is being sequestered by the your trees and everything, and your plants and stuff like that? Excuse me. And then... let's see if we can extrapolate that to the total amount of carbon that gets absorbed in plant material, et cetera, et cetera. So what they did, they went back through the records and they chose the period 1963 to 1967. Mm. And the reason they chose that period was because that there weren't no nuclear tests then, but there were very, very small ones. So there were no major big spikes of carbon-14 that were being added to the atmosphere at that stage, okay? And so therefore that meant you had a constant amount of C14 in the atmosphere, but that was exchanging between the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, the lower atmosphere, and plants, et cetera. And so what they could do is they know how many nuclear bomb tests there have been, so they know the amount of carbon-14 that would have been put into the atmosphere, so that anthropomorphic, so they had a fair idea of how much was there. And then they could use those data to figure out how much C14 must have entered the biosphere at that stage, okay? So the biosphere being essentially plants, okay? And now people have tried to do this before using various methods, and the best estimates at the moment come to between 43 and 76 trillion tons of carbon that are absorbed into the biosphere every year.
That sounds like a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah.
It is a lot. However, the work that these guys have done, that now says that the minimum, their minimum value on the basis of this new study, their minimum value is upwards of 80 trillion tons a year.
Right.
Okay.
That's more, right?
And yeah. Well, from the previous lower level, that's almost double what they thought. Okay. So that's a good thing. We know that there's a lot of carbon being sequestered in plants. But again, the problem is, where it is getting sequestered. And what they're showing is that more C14 is being incorporated into the leaves and foliage and stuff like that, the stuff that goes annually.
Right.
Okay.
So
basically what seems to be happening is that the plants are sequestering more carbon than we thought, but
it's temporary.
Right. Yeah. They're sequestering it for a shorter amount of time. Exactly. Okay. So basically the take home message is let's cut down those emissions because it's just a sensible thing to do.
Yeah, that definitely seems a little bit more worrisome than I initially may have represented it to be.
Yes, yes.
But hopefully these other stories, I mean, while a little bit freaky, less scary perhaps for the future of humanity.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, with tea at least. This one, I mean, mind-boggling to me that this would actually have an impact. What's going on with this tea?
Well, I did like this. I was sort of thumbing through wherever I get these stories.
The world of science.
The world of science, absolutely. And there was one headline that just sort of jumped out, and it just said, "Storm Kieran's low pressure made tea taste worse," says scientists. So,
I mean, that's incredible.
So, of course, this is The Guardian. It's English, of course, as it has to be, because you've got to have your tea just right if you are English. Okay.
Naturally.
Right, so what has this got to do with this storm, the Storm Kieran? And I'm probably not pronouncing it right, any Irish folk out there, sorry. Right, so November last year, there was a big storm that went through Europe.
Yep.
Do we count the UK as being Europe anymore? I'm not sure. So the UK and Europe.
Oh, yeah, I
suppose. Okay, Ireland, the UK. Actually, Ireland, the UK and Europe. Yeah. There we go. And so, tragically, 21 people died as a result of this. There were sort of 160 to 200 kilometre hour winds, you know, just there were 9 tornadoes that spawned. It was a big deal, you know, not good. And so, of course, this is meteorologists meet and drink, this sort of stuff. And so there are a bunch of meteorologists at the University of Reading. And, you know, they got very excited by this, I guess, because that's their stock and trade. And what happens in these big storms is that the air pressure drops, okay? And when the air pressure drops, obviously the sea rises because you've got less pressure and, you know, you get your king tides and stuff like that and flooding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So by how much did the air pressure drop is the big question there. So normally the air pressure, which is measured in this very arcane unit called bars, right, normal atmospheric pressure is 1.013 bar.
Right.
Okay, so there's your reference
that
number there.
That sounds like a good amount,
1.013.
Got it.
And so the pressure in Reading, in the University of Reading, got down to 0.956 bar.
Right. Okay. I don't know if that's really bad or...
So essentially, it's basically 5% pretty much.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so...
That's a lot of bar.
Yeah. It is. Now, where does the tea come into this? Okay, well, first of all, that was the lowest pressure that had been measured since 1989. So this was
very
a big,
low bar.
This is a big storm.
Yeah. Or very high bar. For bar.
Oh, geez. No. So, yeah. So what's it got to do with tea? Well, to make a perfect cup of tea, you've got to have your water boiling, don't you?
Okay. Naturally.
And what temperature does water boil at? Here we go. I told you there'd be a quiz. Yosef.
100
there
degrees.
There we go, yes. Bam, there we go.
Big science numbers here.
Right, 100 degrees. Now, there's a caveat to that. Water boils at 100 degrees, provided you are at one atmosphere pressure, or 1.013 bar,
let's say.
Okay, now, If your pressure varies from that, then in fact the boiling point of water changes. Now, if you go up to the top of Mount Everest, for example, and you try and make yourself a cup of tea up there,
Not so easy.
You're going to be out of luck because water boils at around about 70 degrees Celsius on top of Mount Everest.
Oh, easier?
Well, no, because it's boiling at a lower temperature. So you're not getting up to that 100 degrees.
Right, that's going to get you need your water to be hotter.
Your tea goodness out of that.
So much worse.
So that's what happened here, is that the pressure was so low that the water
was not
would have
boiled,
and they actually did this. They actually boiled the jug and everything and measured the water temperature, and it was 98 degrees.
Mm.
Okay. So you're not going to make a perfect cup of tea at 98 degrees.
Yeah, it can't be steeped
properly. If you're a tea freak. You know? But then the question then becomes, okay, so here's your science lesson for the day, listeners and everybody. So why does the air pressure affect the temperature at which water boils?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I'm going to hazard a guess that's going to be quite bad, but I do remember the air pressure was higher, last, it was a couple of weeks ago, and it was forcing out clouds, and I'm wondering if that has something to do with it, but I couldn't tell you confidently.
Well, it's all to do with what you mean by boiling, and it's very surprising to me whenever I get an intake of first-year students and ask them what boiling's all about, what's happening when something's boiling.
But the particles are really fast,
right? Yeah, nah.
I'm not a science student. I won't confess to know exactly what boiling is.
Okay, so here's a quick one-minute lesson on what boiling is. So above any liquid, you've got molecules of that liquid in the vapor.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so you've got a glass of water, you've got the liquid water, and above the liquid water are molecules of water vapor that have escaped from that liquid. Okay?
Naturally.
And they exert a pressure because they're a gas, and all gases exert pressure.
Yep.
Right, so the liquid will boil when that pressure of those water molecules above the liquid water equals The atmospheric pressure that is pressing down.
Okay. Yeah.
So what we call the vapor pressure of a liquid. Okay.
It'll start going up once it can.
When that is equal to the atmospheric pressure, then basically the bubbles can't get out of the liquid and it starts to boil.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's what boiling's all about. So the lower the atmospheric pressure, the lower The boiling temperature, right? And there you go. You've now just passed first year chemistry. There you go.
That's the whole thing.
And that's basically it in a nutshell. Yeah. Okay. So that is why your tea would have tasted worse in early November with Storm Kieran.
All those people who are wondering now,
yeah, exactly.
You know, you've got your answer. And also why your tea tastes worse just generally if there's high or low pressure, I think, it's
a touch tenuous, isn't it? You'd have to be a real tea snob to know that you're not at 100 degrees and you're at 98 degrees. But perhaps we've got a few
listeners who are real tea snobs very happy with this newfound knowledge.
And then we're not going to go on whether you put the milk in first or second. We're just not going to go there.
I don't think that would possibly lose us, those listeners. And then what have we got lastly here about this millipede?
Right, so here's a question. When is extinct?
I'd assume when they're all dead, right?
When they're all dead. Yeah. How do you tell when they're all dead? And that's a really, really good question. So, you know, there are people who believe that there are still moa down in Fiordland. And look, heck, it would be very, very unlikely.
I mean, those are pretty big.
There are parts of Fiordland where no human has set foot. I absolutely guarantee that.
Right.
You know, it's wild and woolly out there. So there could be something down there that has evaded us humans for a while.
Yeah.
The South Island kokako. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one as well. And again, they reckon that they might have seen one in Southland in December last year. So it's been thought to be extinct for many years.
I'd imagine also once you get smaller with the animal, the harder it is to determine.
Yeah, of course. And so extinct might just mean that we haven't seen it for a long time, but it's still there.
Those dinosaur believers can hold out hope.
No. Right. No, the dinosaur deniers who said they never existed in the first place, but we're not going to go there. Right. So this sort of piqued the interest of a bunch of folk in Madagascar. And Madagascar is a place of just heaps of different...
You can see them all in the movie.
Yeah. So stupendous biological... what's the word? Variety. Yeah. Okay.
Lots of,
so there's a whole bunch of things there that sort of exist nowhere else on the planet. and meaning that therefore there's probably a lot of things that have gone extinct there, seeing as it's got a large, you know, so biodiversity, that was the word I was after. Okay, so they thought, right, let's go and have a look for some of these things that we have thought are extinct. Can we find them? And so they went to a national park called Makira, which is the largest sort of rainforest in Madagascar. And they basically had a list of 30 species that they were going to look for that had been thought to be extinct. And of these, we had 3 mammals, 3 fish, 7 reptiles, 12 insects, and 5 spiders.
All right.
And their job basically over a week was to look for these things and see if they were around. And they found the 3 fish.
All three fish.
Okay. And in all, so of the 30 species that they're looking for, they found 21.
Oh, that's a bit embarrassing, I'd imagine.
Well, embarrassing's one word, but I think brilliant's another word, you know.
I mean, also after 1 week of... Maybe the other 9 are still out there as well.
Well, again, you know, of course they could be. And remember, I mean, the takahe was thought to be extinct until, when was it found again? 1948 or something, I think.
I wasn't around.
Neither was I, folks, neither was I. So of these 21 species, I think the most impressive was this big, or giant, as they call it, millipede, which has the Latin name Spirostreptus sculptus, and that hadn't been seen since 1897.
Oh, so quite extinct.
Yeah, and quite extinct. And so they managed to find this, which I think, you know, is absolutely brilliant. So, you know, maybe all hope is not necessarily lost. There's a lot of wild places on the planet, like, you know, the Amazon, that's, you know, again, people would never have set foot in. And these, you know, isolated islands like Madagascar and New Zealand, of course,
yeah,
obviously,
for sure.
You know, you go down Fiordland, it's wild, 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 wild down there. Who knows what might still be alive down there, you know? So I think that's a nice way on which to end today's hopeful message.
Yeah,
of hope.
Yeah.
There we go.
Just to add a little bit, I don't know if you have this information on you, but how giant are we talking with a giant millipede?
Oh, I think they said it was around about 10 centimetres or something. It was a decent...
Yeah,
size
not for, one you'd for a want to find in your house.
Oh, look, they're harmless. They've just got lots of legs. That's
yeah.
All,
so. I was speaking earlier about how too many legs for me. just a bit scary. 8 is enough for any animal in my personal books. All right, thank you, Alan, for coming in today.
A pleasure.
Thank you, Mosat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Mosat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.